Welcome to The Color Cast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myers, a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City.
And I'm Josh Pitok, a colorist in Los Angeles. And this week we want to talk about NAB 2013, where all three of us will actually be there in full effect at the Colors Meetup, the show floor. We're going to be all around checking out the new stuff that all the vendors have to offer. This podcast, we want to focus primarily on the options for color, too, since there's a lot of other podcasts that have been talking about what you can expect camera-wise or all that stuff at NAB. But I thought it would be really cool if we could talk specifically about the color options that we're going to see at this next NAB.
I think you bring a good point there. One thing I was thinking about the other day was actually, every NAB, it seems like somebody's got some kind of groundbreaking new product or a new price point on an existing product. It's usually Blackmagic brings in some kind of earth shatterer. And I was just, it's sort of an awareness that our industry is like evolving at a pace that it hasn't been before. We're in a kind of a new playing field where we get an enormous amount of improvement in the quality of product that we're getting and the price point that we're getting in every single year. It seems the cost of entry gets lower and what you get for your money gets higher and higher. And so, I think one thing to keep in mind is as we kind of look forward is, where is that kind of new paradigm going to take us?
Yeah, and I don't know how Blackmagic is going to top what they did last year.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm going to be really interested in is sort of how they handle, this sort of face-to-face with their customers wanting cameras. I think that they're finally, I guess the word is that they're finally getting cameras out there, right? But they probably had a thought last year that they wanted to maybe doing like what the revision on the Blackmagic Cinema camera would be, So I wonder if they're just going to stay pat, continue to focus on the current iteration of it because it just hasn't been out in the wild quite that long yet.
Is it ironic that they're right next to the Red booth then?
They're like, yeah, it's the two ends of the spectrum.
Red has also kind of made a mark for themselves as being sort of lowering the price, the cost of entry to a lot of stuff. So they're still kind of selling high end cameras, but they had Scarlett, a couple of years ago, and now they're going to be talking about Dragon in all likelihood. We'll see if they bring up the laser projector again. I want to see if they actually are showing it again, or if they're just kind of letting it go into the ether, off into the dark night, for whatever reason.
I mean, do you think that's a realistic thought that they're not continuing it, or how about this, that there's a thought that it might not be a solvent product, or how would you put it?
I would say, well, right now, I mean, they've been so mum on it for a year now, and when they kind of showed it at NAB, they said, oh, here's a working prototype, and this is a real product, and we're going to have it out before the end of the year. And that was the end of the year, was 5 months ago, 4 months ago. So, we haven't seen it yet. They haven't said a word about it in months and months. So that could mean one of two things. It could mean it's ready to go and they're just like, going to shock everybody and be like, here's, available today, order it now. here's the red laser you've been waiting for. Or something else happens. I think what you see a lot of from Red, and this is both kind of what's good about Red and I think what bothers some people about Red, is they are very open about what they're developing. And so they make announcements about products before they've kind of really engineered the product all the way. So I think you saw that with Dragon and the announcements that have sort of been leaking out from Dragon as development has been continuing, is it went from being something that was just going to be a sensor upgrade for the Scarlett to now being something that is going to be a whole new body because the Scarlett body just isn't able to handle that bandwidth. But of course, they're also saying that it's going to be much more powerful than they anticipated, right? They're saying 18 stops and whatever else. So we'll see what they actually show. But, I mean, you know, I think the red laser is another example of that where, you know, they had, obviously they had a prototype they were showing, but how far along in development they were, we don't know. I mean, it may be they're done and maybe they're waiting for content. Maybe they're waiting for Red Ray to, or Oda Max to kind of come through, and that's what's holding back the red laser. Or,
right, and Red Ray is a shipping product right now as well, right?
I don't think it is shipping. I think one of those things where they said they were going to ship, and they're taking orders, but I don't think it's shipping. I'm going to go and check right now.
I think there's a bunch of companies that are going to need to deal with that. So maybe this is like, you know, NAB 2012 V2, you know, where so many companies that introduce products that were not ready for, you know, distribution and manufacturing yet are going to be showing us the actual version that will ship, you know, Smoke 2013, we're wondering about that speed grade,
right.
You know, and then there's stuff like, you know, Red Lasers. So those are all products that were like on the cusp, at the precipice. And now we're like, okay, are we there yet?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, you bring up a good point is, you know, last year you saw a lot of products announced that were really exciting but just weren't matured yet. And I think that's a pattern that you've seen kind of develop over the past few years as well. It's like you see, you know, the first year you see the announcement of the product and maybe you see something ship over the course of the year. But the second year you see a really mature product being announced that's got, you know, kind of the kinks worked out or version 2.0 or whatever. I just checked, the Red Ray Player is not, in fact, shipping. It's marked coming soon. So yeah, that hasn't shipped yet. So I mean, but this is like anybody who follows Red, you've seen this sort of pattern, and it's just like, you know, you just have to add, and that's the same thing for Blackmagic. Obviously, the cinema camera, you know, they said they would ship in July, and they had issues with manufacturing, and so they shipped in limited quantities, and they're just now kind of ramping up production in terms of quantity. So, you know, with Blackmagic, obviously they have, with every manufacturer really, they have plans, you know, not just for that year, but for the following year and the year after. And sometimes you wonder, like, you know, do these unforeseen delays cause adjustments in the timing for the rest of their announcements? You know, it's kind of a decision you have to make as a manufacturer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that them announcing the camera last NAB was pretty brilliant because that's all everybody was talking about.
Sure. And by the way, have you guys seen any footage from the Blackmagic Cinema Camera?
Yeah, I mean, I saw the ones that they released with the girl playing pool.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the only one, really, that I've seen.
So I've done a couple of jobs that were shot on that. And, I mean, obviously there's caveats to any camera. You know, you're dealing with sort of shortcomings. But what I've seen from the camera has actually really impressed me. For $3,000, it's an insanely good camera. And
yeah, I mean, that's 5D Mark III range.
Right, and well, you have a smaller sensor than the 5D Mark III, but you have a much better kind of image in terms of latitude and the characteristics that we generally associate with a high-quality image. You know, you're not making the compromises that you make with an H.264 off right. of a 5D. So, you know, by all those measures, the camera is a real prize, and it's a wonderful camera. It's just that obviously, I mean, Blackmagic would have preferred to have, you know, have it in out in volume by now. I think the volume's kind of catching up. You see it for sale in places, but and then they also announced the Micro Four Thirds version, which I don't think has shipped yet, and that was kind of an exciting announcement because it opened up a lot of lenses.
So last year, I can't remember when it was, but Blackmagic actually announced that they were going to buy Cintel, right? The film scanning company.
Yeah.
It'll be really interesting to see what that fruit bears. You know what I mean? Because we'll see. I mean, would they have a film scanner? And a lot of people have also said, at its core, if you think about it, a film scanner is kind of like a camera. Are they going to use maybe some of that
technology?
That technology, right, for the Blackmagic Cinema Camera.
That's a really compelling proposition. You know, I think you know, what they've done in terms of cost efficiency on that camera, if they could apply that towards a scanner. So if you consider, like that camera being sort of on par with kind of the Scarlett model, where it's, you know, whatever. I think Scarlett is $13,000 basically with the package. Is that right, Jason?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's like 10 base, I think, and then, yeah.
So if you're looking at something that's like one-third the price, and if you consider a kind of archival scanner to be around $150,000, $160,000, if you do something that's one-third the price of that in the $40,000 range, I think you'd have a really, really compelling proposition for a lot of shops that aren't in scanning today to get into scanning.
Right. I mean, is that a really huge I was wondering if that was a really huge business, but we'll have to ask Jim Wicks, right? He hits his like bread and butter these days.
Well, he doesn't do scanning himself, right? He has the scan, so he's been doing these these restorations of these Mexican films, and they get scanned in Mexico, and he gets the DPX files and does the restoration, the color portion of the restoration. But that's a good example of, like, you know, there are these enormous archives of film that are sitting in vaults, and they're not going to last forever, and there's going to be a point where you're not going to be able to do anything with that film, right? The film projectors are disappearing. Film exhibitions disappearing. The ability to process film is disappearing. The ability to make new prints of film is disappearing. And sooner than later, the ability to scan film is disappearing. So for people who own film as a property, you have to get some kind of long-term storage for your masters in place, and right now that's a really expensive proposition. If you're doing 4K scans of a film, it gets really, really, really expensive. If you could make that cheaper, there's a lot of business to be had there. So I mean I do think that that's a market that's waiting to be tapped that hasn't been tapped yet.
Yeah, you hit on a really good point too about the storage and the costs involved. Everyone says this NAB is going to be all about 4K, right? We can all kind of agree that everyone has that theme in mind with this NAB. So if you take that into consideration, you figure that there's going to be a lot of noise from the storage companies, archive solutions, and all of that as well. So it'll be cool to see what they have available at their booths with the idea that people will be shooting more 4K.
Do you think, Josh, I mean, being primarily in the broadcast world, like, do you see 4K being a factor for you this year, 2 years from now, 3 years from now? Like,
well, the only thing I have to base it on is how long it took us just to get to HD,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty long. It's probably about 5 or 6 years after it was being broadcast.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
I mean, for certain things, I think for a show like, say, Survivor, it would be awesome to see that in 4K. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certain shows that I think could really benefit from that.
Amazing Race.
But, yeah, Amazing Race. And
anything
think
that, CBS even, produces, in other words.
Yeah, I think that even your standard episodic TV would be pretty awesome to see in it as well.
Well, you remember, I mean, when HD came about, people were like really concerned about, you know, makeup for HD and, you know, how to make people look good for HD. And HD is really harsh on skins and it's hard to look good in HD. And so 4K brings that whole set of issues all over again. You know, people are going to be really concerned about how they look in 4K. But I do think that if you consider the length of the transition from SD to HD, a lot of that had to do with kind of the switch over from sort of analog paths to digital paths. Now that we have these digital pathways in place, I think I do think the kind of the switch over from a HD format to a UHD format is going to be a lot faster than the previous switchover was. But that's just my speculation.
Yeah. I mean, I still haven't had a show that we did in stereo either, so.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't think that'll ever happen.
The question is just like, which gimmick is going to take off, right? We're just going to keep trying gimmicks every year until one of them catches. So like next year, if 4K doesn't work out, next year it'll be like Smell-O-Vision will be the thing that everybody's like, Smell-O-Vision's the future of television.
That's right.
Just whatever it takes to sell everybody yet another set is what manufacturers are going to be pushing for.
I think I'm gonna actually change my focus to be a smellerist.
That would actually be an interesting line of work, I think. Oh, man.
I have to get my nose calibrated for this.
You have to get your nose calibrated.
I don't even know what would be involved with that.
That's a good, like, would there be, like, a palate cleanser for your nose that you'd have to, like, sniff in between shots? Would you be like, you know, smelling like a smelling salt.
Hmm. And of course, women would have superior innate smelling
abilities.
That's
right.
That's true.
So, okay, yeah. So back to Black Magic. You figure that it's so about every year they release a new version. It'll be interesting to see if they come with V10 or not, and potentially what that'll have in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the pattern, it's been every NAB. They've gone from, you know, the last 4 years, it's been V7, V8, V9, right? So I get you can make inferences from that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what do you think the big next step is going to be for Resolve? I mean, is there something that do you think refinements are due, or do you think it's going to be something really sort of like a more redesign like the way they had last year?
I mean, I don't see it being too – I mean, the last update was pretty intense. It changed the interface. It changed what tabs it had in it as well, and – the workflow a little bit as well. So, I can't see it doing anything way crazier than it already does, but who knows? You can really never tell. I never would have expected them to release a camera last year, so.
They seem to have the resources to really pull off big ideas. You know, they've gotten to a point of like sort of critical mass now that they can, you know, really go for, you know, ideas that they come up with. And, you know, making a camera from scratch is really tough. And they've, even though they had problems, and you know what, I think it really demonstrates that making a camera is hard, you know, and that's fine. That's a good thing, you know, in a certain sense. There's a lot going on in a camera, you know, and so they've created one and it's being well received. And even though it's had some hiccups, you know, they'll get it done. And so same thing with Resolve. It sounds like they were able to put a lot of energy into version 9. And then I guess the one big thing would just be if version 9 is the Resolve for the masses. It's completely been sort of retooled for the New World Order, assuming that the older version was really tooled for, you know, the heavy iron days. You know, now do they have any new ideas about what color is going to be about? So they've already adopted in, you know, concepts for DITs with the ability to drag footage in and quickly get at it. And it's being used by a lot of people for transcoding. So those immediate thoughts have been sort of taken care of. I just wonder if they have any ideas for what will be important for color for the next several years that they're going to start tackling. So, or maybe they'll stand pat, you know, because it is really good as it is. So
the one thing that it doesn't look very sexy in a demo, but I think that they could do some work on is the workflow. I really think that still the Avid to Resolve workflow has its problems. You look on the forums, there's always somebody complaining about how it doesn't work and how they have problems with it and all that. So it's tough to use that as a major upgrade strategy, I guess. So that, and I'd love to see them kind of integrate what they do with base light in terms of showing you how different versions of grades look. So you could put maybe like four different grades on a screen at the same time, or four different versions of a grade on the screen at the same time. So you could kind of show them, okay, which do you want to pick, A, B, C, or D?
Mm-hmm.
But who knows, I think, if that infringes on their copyrights or something.
or they get the red. I'm pretty sure has a patent on that.
Right.
I do think, like, just to kind of give the counterpoint to that, which I do think, like, showing people one thing at a time is sometimes a little more, because if you're doing side by side, I think like if you're looking at two things side by side, sometimes you make. You're biased your decision in a way that you wouldn't if you were just looking at it as a one-off, you know? So some things that look really nice in terms of looks, that may be a softer look or a less contrasty look, may not play as nicely in a side-by-side with a more contrasty look or a harder look.
Yeah, I buy that. That's true. Yeah. And maybe you could use that idea to your advantage. So they choose the look that you want to have. You're like, oh, I'll make this one just a little bit more magenta. So they choose this one.
That would be one of my biggest requests, actually, would be, because I got used to that in Scratch, and also the way that the viewers in Scratch are large. They're quite big. I mean, I guess, you know, Scratch looks a lot like, you know, a lot of Autodesk products where the majority of the screen is actually dedicated to viewers, and then the lower third is dedicated to tools, and then those tools, you can move through panels pretty quickly. And so the thing that I find tough is that I would really love to be able to take a lot of the references that people give me, whatever they are. They could be still images or other videos and things like that, and be able to, you know, quickly use them side by side in Resolve easily. I've found that doing the sorts of things I did in Scratch where I was getting a lot of these reference looks from people was real easy in Scratch, mostly because Scratch seems to sort of, you know, really pride itself on being able to handle any format known to man, you know, sort of like the high-end VLC viewer of post-intermediate, you know. And the thing is that it really is helpful to be able to just take that stuff in, not worry about how it's formatted, and just look at it at a basic level. And then in Resolve, I had a recent project where the director was giving me a ton of prior looks. And it was just more cumbersome, not only because of a single viewer where you're constantly having to wipe, but also just because I guess I discovered that in the conform view, you're able to play back your reference video, but I guess you're not able to play back your conform view when you're actually in color. Is that right? Because that's actually something I ran into and was surprised that wasn't there. But because of this project, I really wanted to do it. I'd never done it anywhere other than conform. But, you know, those sorts of things that you know, you maybe sort of take for granted, just the ability to see two things at once, what you're working on, what you're referring to, with enough resolution that you can really dig into each image and figure out what's going on quickly rather than constantly resizing or wiping or whatever. I would love that. That would help me a lot. Mm. So
I would say, I mean, I do think the split screen view kind of covers that a little bit. It's not like a side by side necessarily, but you know, you can like split screen to the reference movie and sort of have a split in the middle of the screen and kind of compare A/B if you desire to. And then what I actually do, like, kind of have references is so the still store, you can load any still you want into it. So I'll just load some JPEGs in there and play them back as stills to pull them up on the screen and kind of A/B stuff. But, you know, you're right. Yeah, I mean, you know, all these things are kind of like, you know, a little bit subjective. And then they're also kind of tied to the approach and the strategy of the software, right? So, you know, and this is why we have, you know, we're lucky to kind of have an industry that's sort of vibrant, and we have several different options in terms of color software and DI software. So you can find things that work for you, and some apps handle things a little bit differently, and some, you know, some apps handle, you know, maybe handle some things in the way you prefer, and other things in the way someone else would prefer. I would say that I think just on the question of version, the next version of Resolve, let's say, I think if you look at version 9, a lot of time obviously was spent on the UI, which I think kind of lays the groundwork for stuff that may come in the future, because they really, you know, they really cleaned up the UI in a way that would allow you to put more things into it. Than the old UI was getting a little bit cluttered with kind of all the features. Whereas the new UI has, you know, kind of cleaner tabbing, and so you're able to have more functionality into the UI. And so I do think that was a thought going into the kind of the UI redesign, is how do we design a UI that's going to work not just for today, but also be kind of expandable for future iterations.
I think that that's actually a really good segue into SpeedGrade, because it does not look like an Adobe app at all. It doesn't seem like. Do you think that there's going to be like an Adobe-fication of SpeedGrade at this next NAB?
I think that SpeedGrade doesn't need to worry about what it looks like. I think it needs to worry about more whether it's, you know, able to be used.
Right.
So from my perspective, and I haven't put a ton of time into SpeedGrade. I'm probably put, let's say, 2 or 3 honest attempts to check it out over the last year since NAB 2012. But I don't think SpeedGrade's you know, interface is all that terrible. I think there is some stuff that definitely could use some reworking. I know some people have complained about how things are arranged on the screen, and that it does have sort of a small icon, small control kind of angle to it. But I think they're trying to get a lot done in a single panel and then sort of reveal things as you need to see them. But more than that, I mean, they just really need to make, at a minimum, round tripping with Premiere really elegant. And I know that there are people who have figured out some methods and stuff like that, but if I hear anything or sort of experience any feedback about what's going on with that, once they get that really solid as in, let's say, the way Media Composer and Symphony work, or the way even Apple and, you know, Color used to work, and those sorts of things, that partnership, that it's just always easiest and the least technically demanding on the user to go with Premiere and SpeedGrade. That's a compelling solution that a lot of people are using Premiere now. And if they can say that they have easy access to a color application that makes conform as painless as possible, which is a big, big part of getting color done. I mean, you guys probably are in a situation where half the time is conform and half the time is grading, and sometimes it's a worse ratio than that. So if they can make it pain-free to the best extent they can, a lot of people will jump on board. But this is the year, because they've had a year now to do that. And if they don't make it, let's say, noticeably better, I think people will look at them as maybe spinning their wheels. But I'm excited. I would like to see it work. You know, it'd be nice to have another option and something to take a look at. So,
yeah, I would say that that's one of their potentially Resolve's competitor, because obviously Resolve is being offered for free as a Resolve Lite. But you could say that SpeedGrade's being offered for free as well, because it's just bundled with the rest of the applications that people already maybe subscribed to instead of bought.
Yeah, I would emphasize beyond just workflow. I think the UI is, because functionally, I think what, you know, it stems also from its sort of its pedigree, and SpeedGrade was kind of a really high end solution that was meant, sort of like Resolve was, you know, was meant to be run on this very specific hardware, and these very sort of well-defined system parameters, so a large enough screen to run the UI and all this other stuff. I think if you open up the SpeedGrade UI on like a MacBook, you know, it's a difficult thing to use. It's not at this point a really clean UI, just because it's so kind of cluttered, and I find it kind of hard to just work the buttons and find the controls that I need to use. So, and that's just because I'm, you know, working on it in a kind of a limited screen environment. If I have it on a much larger screen, obviously it's a much easier interface. And so I mean, you do kind of have to, it takes time and resources in order to make an app that was designed for a very narrow set of users applicable to a very wide set of users. And so the question is just, is Adobe investing that time? And do they have that kind of mindset in terms of the way they're developing the app? We shall see. You know, Adobe has a lot of technology in terms of getting, you know, one of the biggest things to me that sort of made SpeedGrade a kind of a non-starter was the lack of video I/O solutions, or real video I/O solutions. That to me, right off the bat, is kind of a non-starter. And so hopefully they address that. I would say that's the first thing. That's the first kind of giveaway as to how seriously they're taking it, is whether or not they address the video I/O issue.
I mean, I guess they had it on PC, right, with the Quadro card and SDI out, but they didn't have it on Apple. So that's a big part of their market. And if they can make that other half or whatever represents, you know, well taken care of with either what, I guess. Well, what would they do? Would they go, they try to support both maybe AGA and Blackmagic?
So like the other Adobe apps already have this hook into this Adobe Transmit functionality, which is like their video I/O technology, which they have the third-party guys hook into. So AGA hooks into it, BMD hooks into it, Matrox hooks into it. So the question is just, ideally you would see SpeedGrade hook into that, functionality, this way that Premiere hooks into it, or even Encore, for example. Encore, you can get video I/O out of the Blu-ray authoring, and because it hooks into that pipeline. So if they can hook into that pipeline, then you have a nice video I/O system there.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I missed at the last NAB that I was really bummed out about was I didn't see Mystica, and I'd love to see what they have to offer, because it's being used on what, like, really high end films these days too.
Yeah, it seems like Mystica sort of like has taken over kind of the Pablo space in the DI world of being like the go to solution for like 3D films, and on top of that also HFR. If you're doing an HFR movie or you're doing a 3D movie, you're probably using Mystica somewhere in your pipeline. It seems like it's kind of the solution that, or the system that's kind of on the uptick right now. It seems to be the one that's sort of catching on and filling that kind of void where a lot of people are kind of leaving Pablo behind. Mystica seems to be SGO, and Mystica seems to be where it's going into.
Yeah, it's a layer based system as well, right?
Yeah, they have a really cool, like, they have a really cool timeline kind of metaphor, like a desktop timeline metaphor. That's sort of, it's almost like a node compositing environment for your timeline. You can kind of zoom in. It's totally scalable. And it's got, I mean, it has some nice, obviously the conform is really robust. People really like that about it. And the 3D tools are pretty cool. So it's got a lot of nice features.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time at the Mystica booth last year, and it was interesting because I was there to look at color tools, but because they were doing a lot of revisions, actually, from what I understand, all of the effort that Park Road put into using Mystica on The Hobbit, there was a ton of feedback, like a really, really large feedback loop between them and SGO on their version, I guess version 7 color tools, I think they call them. And so the thing that's happened is that they finally get to show those sort of at NAB. And last year, when you ask color questions, they were always like, okay, I'll show you this, but it's all about to change. You know. So as a colorist, that was kind of a limiting experience. And this year, I think they're going to feature those. So it'll be a great year to take a look at Mystica as a color tool. And then the other thing that's really amazing is that it's probably, I mean, you know, Mystica isn't cheap, but it's probably the closest anyone has come to the all-in-one super app that can do everything. I mean, I know that Pablo occupied that space for a long time, but really so many of the people that were at Quantel moved over to Mystica. And a lot of those guys, like the demo artists you'll see, and a lot of the people that are sort of front-end customer-facing people were all at Pablo for many years, a bunch of them, and are now at Mystica thinking that Mystica is actually taking the ball and running with it a bit. I know that Quantel has been held back a little bit by the fact that they were moving all of their stuff from the MME card. So, you know, Quantel's version of CUDA was these multimedia engine cards that, you know, were part of the great expense of a Pablo 4K. So they've moved away from that sort of proprietary sort of DigiDesign style DSP architecture and now moved to CUDA. But that wasn't trivial. I mean, they really had to rewrite everything. So this will be a big year for them as to whether they can remain competitive and, you know, convince people to stay, you know. And that's been a real challenge for them because they were sort of what the big news from, say, 2007, 8, 9, 10, you know, when 4K was being done at the high-end feature level. But now there's a lot of ways to do 4K, and you can do it more affordably. So if you're going to do 4K expensively, you have to really be rails with your software, as in, you know, 64-bit, which Quantel has been, I know that very recently they finally got to 64-bit on their software. And then the other thing is you have to be really exceptional to justify your big iron price nowadays. And so Mystica's come the closest, I think, with like the layer-based timeline, the way that you can pipe between segments, the way you can quickly nest a set of layers into a single clip so that while you're editing, you can use it like a nested composite, I guess is what they have, but with the ability to pipe between those segments independently per segment. I mean, nobody does that that I know of. And so they have a really good shot at demanding your $300,000 if anyone
does.
And
speaking of high end, Luster, big question mark. Is that still something? Is it
a question mark?
Are they going to update it?
Isn't it like an ellipsis now? I think it's moved to, from a question mark to like an ellipsis with like a pregnant pause after.
That's right.
I think the only question is just at what point do they officially, you know, put the gravestone on them on the
yeah,
marker?
Yeah, it's too bad because like, I mean it's not a bad color system either.
Well, not a bad, as in 2012, there were more best pictures graded in Luster than any other app. So, yeah, it's still really – that's the thing that's crazy is that I think Autodesk could really make a gigantic play as much as anyone else out there. But, I'm on the Autodesk forum a lot. I post occasionally, but I read it, like, every day. And everybody is just, please, Autodesk, give it to us and we will reward you with market share. I think they could easily make a play in a similar way that Resolve has with Luster on Mac or Luster on Windows or Luster on whatever. But that's a feature that they want to keep it a bullet point for Flame. And I respect that. So what they ought to do is just make a Luster Advanced or something that Flame people get and just make some sort of variation of Luster. You know, God, it'd be tough to ask, you know, what do you cripple? But maybe even if they were to do something like 2K resolutions and under or something, God, I would take that because a lot of the work that I'm doing, at least myself, is 2K. And I would be happy to have that for all those sorts of projects and get access to those tools and that color science. So I know, Juan, you're like the Undertaker of post. You know, it's like the Mac Pro is definitely, you know, officially dead. Luster's dead. I would hate to be in your crosshairs because it's painful. But what I'll say is that, you know, I love Luster because I love the way it looks. But right now it's being held back for the sake of some other products, it feels like. So I will have the hammer at the other end of the coffin if sometime this year something doesn't come about with it, because people have just have moved on.
Jeez, Jason, I'm sorry I mentioned it.
Yeah, no, that is the most impassioned diatribe ever on the Coloristas. I think that's
tier.
That's a new one.
Tier man.
I'm not going to argue with what you said, Jason, but I will just refine my point, which was my statement about the death is not based on the quality of the of Luster. It's based on the lack of development and really the lack of resources that have been put into it, and the clearly very low place on the totem pole that it encompasses at Autodesk. And I do think that they're making a logical calculation in terms of not really putting resources into it, and that the color market, for better or worse, is a really robust market. There's a lot of solutions, and the resources it would take to kind of bring Luster up to speed to where, or in terms of performance, where a Mystica or a Resolve or a Baselite is at, is probably not insignificant, and the calculation is made that it's probably not worth the time and energy.
So what about things like, you know, Symphony?
Oh, don't get me started. You want to hear a diatribe? Well, I think one of the biggest things is that Symphony lost a lot of its features that just got integrated right into Media Composer. So there was a lot of things that there weren't a lot of things that you were missing out of Media Composer that you get in Symphony. So it was difficult for them to justify the price. I mean, you do get minor things like secondaries and stuff like that in Symphony, but even with a lot of the systems, they're bundled with Boris that's got this effect that's called Correct Selected, and it actually sometimes works as a better secondary than even Symphony's. A lot of the Symphony stuff obviously does play in real time, which you get, but I mean, there's a lot of things that you come to expect from a color correction system that it doesn't have. It doesn't have built-in windows or tracking or all those elements that you really come to expect now. Even a well-integrated control surface, they have one, but really it's not set up in the way that you could really use it with Symphony effectively. So those are all my major problems with it. The pluses are that you get this relational color corrector that you can quickly move through a sequence by color correcting things just by its tape or source clip name. So there's that benefit. And the other benefit is the workflow. It's you take a sequence from Media Composer, you open it up in Symphony. It's essentially the same product. So you really cut out the whole conform part of the workflow. So there's that benefit. But, you know, who knows? I don't see them making that a priority, especially in the shape that Avid is in right now, if you've looked at their stock price recently.
And then what do you guys think of Avid's situation in terms of this litigation or anything that's going on? I mean, do you think that'll have any bearing on people's perception of them at NAB, or will it just be, you know, life's good, don't worry about it?
Well, I think that this is kind of a make or break NAB for Avid in terms of the presentation they make, how they appear to be, how robust their development appears to be, how healthy they seem to be as a company. And I think one of the things I kind of look at when I'm going to NAB is where each company's booths are, how big their booths are versus last year, who's growing, who's got an exciting booth, who has kind of a timid booth, who isn't putting on a booth. You know, that is a kind of indicator as to the health of the company or where they think the value of their resources lies. And so You know, that's one thing I'll look at. You know what? You know, a big giveaway to me in terms of understanding the vitality of, for example, Lustre or DS is I'll go to the Avid booth and I'll be like, hey, where's the DS station? And if it's off in the corner somewhere or nobody knows where it is, that probably tells you something about what the company thinks of that product. And or try doing the same thing at Autodesk with Lustre, Jason, and see what kind of a response you get. You know, it's probably going to be some little side thing that's, you know, they're showing flame and then, oh yeah, we can pull up the Lustre here. And so it's obviously not a major draw for them. It's not a big product. You know, that's a good segue to just wrap this up, because I think, you know, part of it is conjecture. We're speculating at this point. We don't know what it's going to look like. We'll definitely have much more to say during NAB. We'll hopefully be podcasting from NAB at some point. You know, it's one of the rare times that all three of us are together in the same place at the same time, thereby proving that we're not, in fact, the same person. And
like an audiobook with voices.
Yeah, just it's like the Mel Blanc of post.
So, Juan, you have a announcement, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. So last podcast, we asked you guys to review us on iTunes, and in order to enter to win a free Resolve. And so, do we want to do a drum roll? We've picked a winner. It looks like it's Weston W, who I believe is Weston Woodbury. And I will be reaching out to you shortly and congratulating you on your win. So you're the proud recipient of a full Resolve license.
At least he has a daily system now, if he already does.
Courtesy of Blackmagic, by the way. So thank you, Blackmagic, for that very generous gift to our listeners.
Our first giveaway winner. Congratulations.
Yeah, hopefully next one will be a Mystica.
Yeah.
SGO, are you listening?
Yeah, that would be, or maybe Mystica Insight, which seems rare and valuable enough.
a Resolve control surface, perhaps.
Ooh, that'd be nice. We'll get back to you. So, from New York City, my name's Juan Salvo. You can catch me on Twitter at J_Salvo and at JuanSalvo.com.
And I'm Jason Myris. You can catch me on Lift Gamma Gain posting there or on Jason Myris on Twitter.
And I'm Josh Petok. And you can see me on Twitter at Josh Petok or at my website, www.joshpetok.com.
And so we will see you guys at NAB. And if you are able to catch us, we'd love to see you at the Colorist Meetup at the Monte Carlo on Sunday night, which starts at 8 o'clock at the Pub and Keg Room. So a lot of your colorists that you might have been following on the web or that are friends will be there. And then we'll see you on the floor. So until next time, thanks for listening.